Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, Jay, David, and Vicki sit down and discuss current agricultural topics. And as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, Jay.
How are y'all doing today?
I'm doing pretty good.
We've sitting down here in the middle of the day, already had a productive morning getting together and doing some planning for a conference we're all taking part in here in the next couple of weeks. And if the next 45 minutes or an hour can go like the last hour has, it'd be a pretty good show.
That's exactly right.
Sitting lakeside, checking out things on the lake here.
We are working.
Mobile.
We're working from a remote location. We had to, it's a good thing about the equipment we have is we're set up basically to do this show anywhere we want. We've carried it on the road to conferences
many times with us. Yeah.
Yep. And it's just made a good setup for us to be able to do this. Yep. Part of what helps us do that is the equipment we have. Part of what makes it possible is really the format of the show itself. Mm-hmm. The fact that we try to keep it conversational and keep it in a discussion. We don't need a lot of props. We don't need a lot of out things going, but we are set up lakeside here, just a few feet off the Cumberland River. So it makes a pretty nice view while we're sitting here and working.
Oh, absolutely. And, we've had a pretty good spring so far and had a pretty good hay season so far. And I can't remember, and I told Alan on the radio the other morning, I can't remember a time when we had such a stretch in western Kentucky that we were able to get up hay that we weren't pushed because of a rain. That's not always a good thing, and it's certainly not a good thing now, but I don't remember a time where we had this much time in between rains that came at a timely situation where we could get our hay up.
And it came at the same time that farmers that needed to be replanting corn and soybeans, it gave them that same stretch of time to get in the fields and get that replanted too. And so that,
and it looks pretty good.
It does.
The replant that I've seen.
We're recording this here in the first full week of June. And yes, we hit a stretch through the middle 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks of May that were just absolutely fantastic weather for people working. It's dry. We could use the rain. But we have had rain along the way. We're not in the shape that we were last year at this time. Because we've had some rain back in the spring. You dig down in the ground a little bit, you can find some moisture.
But you know, I've seen some corn twisting in some different places, though, on some of these red hills and things. I have seen in different places, Jay. We went to Nashville last Tuesday, and we came back through the country. There's something going on I-24, and we came back up 41. And saw a lot of corn down through that area twisted as well.
I think that's the big thing key there. You said in different places, because I've seen some in Hopkins County. It's situational to the point you mentioned Red Hills. I've seen what are traditionally compacted areas, entrances to field and things like that are showing those signs. So you know it's not far behind. You know we're needing rain regardless. Yep.
Well, and that plant's just naturally going to curl up to conserve the moisture. And so it's that mechanism that's built into that corn plant to, it's getting a little dry. It's getting a little heat. It's getting a little hot out here. I'm going to roll up that leaf a little bit and conserve that water in there. And so
we're supposed to get in the next 3 or 4 days, supposed to be some cooler temperatures, and this morning was kind of cool, to be real honest about it. I came out and to take care of the mules and everything, and it was a little bit cool. But
it was.
We've got corn anywhere from waist tall to about 2 inches, 2.5 inches in some places. So, or some that was, planted here lately that has just popped out of the ground. So, it's going to be a different year. We'll have some corn that'll probably make pretty good, and then we'll probably have some corn that, depending on the rains we get, or may not make.
And there's some cornfields right now, those replanted cornfields that you're talking about. They look a little funny, ugly, so to speak, too, because anytime you got to go in and kill existing crop that's planted, whatever process you use for that, whether it's tillage or whether it's trying to kill it out, chemically, whatever the case may be, there's always some that's going to escape that, and it's going to survive. And so now, particularly in those fields that were worked to try to kill it, you've got corn that's a whole lot bigger than the rest of it, just, you know, scattered throughout the field. So it kind of looks a little funny right now.
I haven't seen any of it yet, but I think there will probably be some abandoned early planted corn that may have got put in beans instead. And we'll see some of that escape corn a little bit later when it outpacing the height of the bean.
That's right.
You know, the ground that I have seen, the folks that went in there and worked the ground, that corn to me looks better than the corn that was, sprayed it and they just no-tilled it back in there.
I
think it looks a lot better. Yeah. You know, for whatever reason, I don't know if you get a little bit of oxygen in the soil or what the reason is, but it does look a lot better.
Mm-hmm. I think that is a lot of it. Used to hear people talk about, well, it needs a little airing, needs stirring, and I think that's what that is. It, whatever reason that crop needed replanting, a lot of the reason this spring was because of the excessive moisture or water.
Yeah. You used to see that in tobacco a lot when I was a kid. When we had a lot of heavy rains and different things like that in some places that maybe held a little water, we always went in there, and my grandfather would always tell me, need to air it out a little bit. Mm-hmm. And
open it up. Yeah, that's what my dad would say. We need to get in there and open it up.
Yeah, I think, and that's why, because to get that oxygen in that soil. Mm-hmm. And the tobacco would come out of it eventually. So, yeah.
And then, too, there's always, you know, that good seed-to-soil contact we like to have. And I think that sometimes helps it, especially – later in the year, like we were talking about, you know, we were talking about, you know, that second, third week of May. Well, it's a lot warmer that time of year than it is when you're planting the first week of April. That ground temp, that, you know, that soil temperature is so much warmer. And so it comes out of the ground a lot quicker and more uniform, too, most of the time. So.
I've always felt like some of those wet spots that ended up underwater and then, you know, water ended up coming off of it. Water adds a lot of weight. So it's probably a little bit of a compaction issue, too, just where that top maybe third or half of an inch is crusted over.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it needs to be opened up, as you say.
You know, we used to have all those rotary holes that we would go in there when it would get a little rain on it and it'd crust over. And, you know, everybody had one. And, you know, you very rarely see folks using those anymore. But, you know, of course, we don't work the ground as much as we used to. I think this year, this spring, I've seen more work ground than I have in a long time. So we may have to get some of those out at some point. This year was not one of those years necessarily, but if we continue to work ground like I have seen this spring, I think, you know, we're going to have to do some things like that if we do get those crusting rains that we have.
That's
you know, some ground just does not lend itself to no-till production. Mm-hmm. And we got to keep that in mind. As much as we like to see that, we live in a world where more conservation tillage type efforts are utilized and utilized for good measure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I don't think you run into those problems when you're using a minimum tillage type tool on some ground. You don't run into that where it crusts over like it did when you were like disking it two or three times. You know, I think it just makes that much bigger difference.
Oh, yeah.
Pore space is different. Particle size is different. It's just not worked as fine.
Yeah.
So that it doesn't compact back up as fine.
Right, right. It's good to set the back in, but them red clods that we used to have set the back in that would mash your finger, you know, it's just a little bit different soil types there. But, you know, hopefully we won't have to do that. Hay harvest, I think, went pretty good. I don't know what y'all been hearing. You know, I've had some fields that turned out really, really good and some that weren't as good, but it was still a decent hay crop, I feel like.
I was going to mention that. I talked to some producers who really made really good hay in places and then some where it just wasn't quite what it had been in the past. Mm-hmm. And I think we can put most of that back on the dry year that we had last year.
Yeah.
Being so dry late in the year that fields didn't get renovated that maybe should have.
I think talking to some of mine producers and just, you know, just hearing folks talk, I think the overall, as far as yield of the first cutting was probably off about a third if it was on average speaking. Now, some, you know, probably not as much. Some may have had a little, you know, more than that than, you know, being off. But on average, I'd say about a third off from a normal year. And I think you're right, Jay. I think that that drought last year. Now, we did. Obviously, we got a little more rain than y'all did last year. But there was still some pockets there in Webster County that missed the rains, too. And so, There was quite a bit of ground still in the county that struggled.
You know, people that are trying to cut hay off of ground that they've pastured, I think that is that that those fields took the biggest hit.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I mean, they just did not respond to fertilizing like you would think a hay field did that maybe didn't have any cattle on it. And I think that's what I experienced at my house and field. We had a field that we grazed. That we cut for hay, and it just didn't, you know, it just didn't turn out as much. But, I mean, still, it was a decent crop. I mean, it wasn't anything bad, but it just didn't seem as thick, you know.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just, when you were saying grazing and all of that, I think one of the things that we in Extension, you know, a lot of times we're trying to think about programs that we can do in the wintertime or topics that we're having at, you know, maybe like we've talked about the beef conference and things like that. But I think one of the things that would be very beneficial that I think producers would like to hear, and I know that, I mean, I would too, is just talking from a soil fertility standpoint. We oftentimes talk about soil fertility, but we talk about soil fertility more in corn and soybeans, or maybe alfalfa or something like that. But it kind of gets skimmed over when you start talking to in like pastures and things like that. But just developing that soil fertility plan in your pastures or when you're grazing, you know, and then hay fields too, obviously, because we know when you cut hay, you're taking everything off of it. There's not going to be that return. But, I mean, I don't know. I'm just throwing that topic out there. What do y'all think about that topic?
I'm glad you did. I'm glad I backed up and let you go first, because that's actually what I was going to talk about. I'm going to add a little more to that. Not only should they have a good soil fertility plan for their pastures and hay fields. I think those who soil test regularly might know or have at least a close idea to where they're at. Mm-hmm. But let's go back. We keep talking about these pastures and hay fields and being off because of the drought last year. But let's think back 2 years ago to the high input prices.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of fields probably didn't get fertilized like they should have because of those nutrient prices. So now we're seeing the real effect of that. But it's not just the dry year, it's soil fertility to go along with it.
Yeah,
I agree. And I mean, Vicki, when you talk about that, a lot of times, the problem is to me, a lot of times, folks that have cattle that are in the row crop business, the cattle deal is a secondary business, and they don't feel like they have time to really put the hours into it or the inputs. But to be honest with you, if you're going to be profitable in that, you've got to manage it just like you do your corn crop or your soybean crop or your wheat crop or whatever. If you manage it just like you do those, I mean, to me, fertility is very important, because the more those animals are grazing, the more days they're grazing, that's the less stored type feed you have to put up. That hay is the most expensive feed that you've got to put through those cows. So as long as they're grazing and the cows are harvesting that grass, I think you're way money ahead. But, I think the management situation is a big deal.
We've heard this said, you know, by the specialists many times before, but really – beef producers, anybody that owns beef cattle should be looking at the fact that they're not selling beef. Mm. They're in the business of selling grass.
Right.
Beef is just how they harvest that grass.
Yep.
And if they treated that grass like they would any other crop that they're trying to sell, it would benefit a lot more from it.
You got to kind of be a grass farmer first. Sure. A lot of people don't want to necessarily say that, or they don't want to do that, but I mean that's what you got to be. You've got to be a grass farmer first, and then you're a beef producer, because the more days you can graze, the more money that's in your pocket. I mean, you can graze for between 30 and probably 50 or 60 cents a day, where if you're feeding hay, it's probably now, gosh, with the input prices, it might be $1.50 or $2.
I was going to say $1.75. Yeah. It's kind of the number I'm thinking of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, if we're thinking about that, and we've got producers that are row crop farmers that maybe, you know, I think a lot of time our part-time farmers, the folks that just do beef, you know, and then they have an outside job, they probably spend a little more time on the management aspect than folks that may have, you know, a bunch of row crops and tobacco and don't have it. You know, they've got a few cattle, you know, maybe 50, 60 head, and they just kind of graze the ground that they can't crop. and they don't put very many inputs into it. But the management of that is just as important as managing that corn or soybeans.
You talked about ground they can't crop. And when we think about our row crop producers who have cattle, most of them have cattle because they have ground that can't be cropped.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And therefore, it's automatically not as good a ground to them. I mean, that's just a mental thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, we talk about, again, in corn, soybean, we know crop rotation is an important part. You know, crop rotation, that needs to be part of the process. And and when we think about pastures and hay ground, it's not that you're rotating the crop, but I always think that if the producer can get in their mind that if they're going to, a third of their ground, pasture ground or hay ground, you know, if you're going to, overseed that or introduce legumes or whatever it's going to be, but think you're going to do something, you know, every year, a third of it. And then every 3 years, you've gone over all of your ground. And, it's not crop rotation, but thinking along those lines that you can do a third of your acreage a year.
Well,
and make some improvements if needed.
You don't have to spend all that money if you want to do it all at one time.
Right.
If you kind of get yourself on that type of rotation, you kind of, you don't have to spend as much money on clover every year. We sowed some lesbethesa this time. First time I've ever done that. My dad was telling me this other day. That's all he used to sow all the time is lesbethesa. And, we actually got a pretty decent stand, but I would have never thought about sowing it as late as I did. And this is what one of the recommendations was from Greg Halich. And if folks want to go back and listen to that bale grazing podcast, it's a good one to pick up. But, he was talking about putting the lesbethesa on and everything. So, I think it works. I mean, and we sow it, that first, about the 5th to the 10th of March. And I honestly never have thought about sowing something that late. And doing that good, because people sow lesbethesa in February. It just doesn't do very good for some reason in our area. Now, this is West Kentucky. For those folks listening outside, you'll have to kind of get with your county extension office to figure out when the best time is. But that's it worked really good. And, I mean, I got a pretty decent stand, to be real honest about it. I was pretty tickled.
If you want good seeding dates and don't have access to your local office, maybe just have time to look it up on your phone. AGR 18 is the publication that we use that has the seeding dates and rates for all grain and forage crops in the state of Kentucky. Years ago when we had printed out publications, it was a trifold, and I kept it folded out kind of like a poster and taped on the back of my wall, back of my door, because I could see it all the time, and I referred to it a lot. So look up AGR 18 if you're listening to this and want that information. You're talking about seeding lesbethesa and February, it does not frost seed as well as clover does. A lot of that, I think, is the seed size, the relative. It's a little bit bigger and doesn't work down into the ground with frost even as well as clover seed does.
Yeah, and I don't know why it doesn't, but it does a lot better when you sow it in March. When people are, our weather is not always the best in February, so this is a option for folks that may be busy in February and may the conditions may not be where they can actually do something in February. So, I mean, this really helps, I think, folks, have another option, another tool in their toolbox, if you will, and to be able to get some legumes sowed on some grass. And the annual lesbethesa really grows good in hot weather, so hopefully we'll see what happens, and I'll keep folks updated as we move along through our podcast. But so far so good on this stuff.
We're in hot weather, as you mentioned. We're just about to the official summer. We're in meteorological summer now after the 1st of June, but going back several shows, we have talked about the use of summer annuals. We had Dr. Chris Deutsch on just a few weeks ago, and we talked about that as well. I could not tell you how many times I have used that information in the past 2 or 3 weeks. Folks looking for some type of option for the summer.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
Just about to that time.
It is. I mean, and that's one of those that you really have to wait till it gets hot. Because I know that sometimes people want to get antsy a little bit and get those put in just a little bit earlier. But I know with talking with our specialists and all, you really want to wait till it's till it's pretty warm. But then, and just as a reminder, in case you haven't listened to that one yet, if you are going to go that route and go with the, you know, those, just don't let it get away from you.
Yeah.
Because they it can get away from you in a hurry. So just
absolutely. Talking with one producer here the other day, he was cutting some wheat hay. And he said, I'm going to be putting this down in permanent grass this fall, but I want something just to bridge me from now till then. And a summer annual is the perfect fit.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. And those will get away, that you know, sorghum, sedan grass and those things. You got to really pay attention to what's going on with those. And, you know, hopefully we're going to get some rain here in the next little bit. So if you have planted that, my guess is that it'll take a jump if it came up and you got a pretty good stand that hopefully we'll get some things going. But, you know, it right now it's just we're just starting to get kind of dry, and we really need some rain. Pastures are starting to they're just kind of sitting there. They're really not hurting, but they're just sitting there. They're really not growing. I bush hog probably last weekend, a couple of days last weekend, and I'll be honest with you, it's just kind of sitting there. It's not really doing anything.
The cooler nights that we've had and the lack of humidity, some of the cooler mornings, and it just hadn't been tremendously hot during the days. Mm-hmm. It's been dry, but it could have been a lot worse now. Because things aren't stressing quite as much as they should have without the rain.
And I haven't seen it in the pastures. The corn is the only thing that I've seen twisted, but the pastures have, you know, just sitting there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really not growing. It's really not doing anything. So hopefully we'll get some rain here in the next few days.
I know we aren't looking like we're going to have to mow our yard this week. It's not. It's just kind of sitting there a little bit, too. So
I've already mowed mine. So.
Yeah. Of course, we mowed a little later last week. But before we leave the summer annuals, David, what's your thoughts on after you do that first cut and going in there and putting a little nitrogen down, if you're wanting to, you know, to really increase your, you know, your yields, or what do you think about that?
Well, you know, it all kind of all depends on the rain, and you know, obviously coming in there with 50 or 60 units of nitrogen is a great idea if it's going to rain. I think that's the big sticking point right now with us is in this area, is it going to rain? You know, but in fescue and ultragrass are the same way. If you took that fescue and ultragrass off of there and you're needing a second cutting, if we can get a rain, it'd be a great time to put some nitrogen down, to be honest with you. And you should, because it'll really help the growth of that you know, hay field or whatever you're trying to cut. You know, it'll make a tremendous difference if you can get some rain. That's the big deal.
And especially, like, going back to your point, Jay, of the high input cost, and that year either no fertilizer or very minimal, and then with the drought, you know, if somebody is kind of light on, looking like they're, you know, used up more of their hay supply last year than what they intended to, and then this first cutting comes off and it's not near what you think it is, or hoped it would be, and just a way to increase, you know, an option if the weather will allow for it, to be able to maybe get a few more rows, you know,
you got
to
do something
for use, you know. And then, as we've said before, I think maybe on a podcast here not too long ago, is make sure you're checking that and don't put it inside too quick, because we don't want a fire either. So lots of things to think about.
And, you know, if you're going to buy some hay, I mean, that's great. And if you need to buy some hay, I would go ahead and do that. I wouldn't wait till this winter, for sure. I would try to go on and do that. But, you know, a hay test would be great to have on some hay. You know, when we get down into this, as Kevin LaRon always says, this holiday hay, I'm not too sure how great it is. So, I mean, if you can get a test on some hay and it's pretty good quality and that kind of thing, you know, then maybe you should look at buying some hay. But, you know, just be careful out there, because there's a lot of hay that's not very good that they'll ask a big price for, just like the regular, good hay.
When we think about testing our hay, one, always remember you want to get a hay probe to do that. So if you're testing your own hay, a lot of extension offices in Kentucky, not all of them, but in Kentucky, a lot of agents do have those hay probes available for producers to come and get and use to go get those samples. So always keep that in mind. And, you know, your sample is only going to be as good as the sample you submit. So your results are only going to be as good as the sample you take. So, you know, try to do a good job on sampling and be representative of the lot or the, you know, the hay field that you're, mm-hmm. you know, that you're testing. So just keep those things in mind as you get your hay test. But my question is, on this newly, on the hay that we've just cut, is there a little bit of a wait period that you need to wait before you get the hay sample, or can you just go right in there and get it right then?
Yeah, I like to sample them in the field whenever it's available. A lot of times when folks will let me know where it's at, and I'm helping them. One of the things I do in Hopkins County, of course, we, part of our county fair, we have a hay test or a hay quality contest for folks to participate in. And I'll actually go out, I'll line all these up well ahead of time, but everybody's first cutting hay, we'll go pull samples and have them all tested at the same time. Mm-hmm. And we use those results to kindly judge the hay. We have a hay bale contest as well that folks can bring some in, but the quality contest is really what tells people, you know, what they have. By participating in that, it's free of charge. Typically, if you go through the Kentucky Department of Agriculture's hay testing program, it's $10 per sample, which is, to it's me, minimal. No minimal. Cost at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. compared to what it's going to, the money it's going to make you by being able to supplement your winter diet for whatever species you're mm-hmm. feeding, horses, cattle, right. whatever. Mm-hmm. But the folks who participate in this program get their hay test done for free. KDA will come down and they run all the tests together at the same time. I like to pull them wherever they're at. If they're right mm-hmm. in the field, I will go around several different bales and pull those samples. If they're already in the barn, that's okay too, as long as I have the face of several different bales mm-hmm. that I can get to and have access to. You can still make a good test out of that.
Well, for those of Jay that have not maybe been testing their hay or and thinking about doing that now, I mean, just talk a little bit about the process. I mean, how do you take a hay sample?
You know, you mentioned earlier using the hay probe, and let's start right there. A grab sample where you would just go up and take a hand and pull some from the outside of the bale is not going to give you any real information of what is representational of that bale itself. That's the weathered part that's outside. It's just not going to give you a quality test. So I like to use a hay sample, an electric drill, a cordless drill, and we will core sample three or four different bales to make enough for a sample. I brown bag them, and a brown bag as opposed to a plastic Ziploc bag allows it to breathe. It allows moisture not to accumulate. Whatever it is, if you're putting dry hay in a bag, you don't want to put it in a Ziploc bag because that moisture is going to increase and
build
up. And
if that's the only bag you have, then leave it unzipped.
Leave it unzipped. Take a pair of scissors and cut some small slits in the size of it. I'll say this for hay samples, but the same recommendation goes for folks who are bringing plant samples yep. into our offices. Yep. Cut some little slits into that Ziploc bag where it'll have a chance to breathe and not condensate and break down that sample that you're wanting us to look at.
And don't leave it on the dash you pick up 2 days before you bring it in.
Or across the weekend. Don't pull that sample on Friday and bring it to us dried up on Monday.
Well, I know we're fixing to get right into wheat harvest, and I know we got some safety stuff. Vicki, we were talking before the show ever started. We talked about some safety things. And, you know, as we get into wheat harvest, and I'll caution folks about, you know, the equipment that's going to be on the road, and we need to share the road, and our farmers need
Absolutely.
To, when they have an opportunity to get off, they need to do that and let folks by. But our folks that are not involved in agriculture, just be patient. Mm-hmm. Getting behind a tractor and driving for, I forget what the statistic is, for 3 or 4 miles is like sitting at a stoplight. Mm-hmm. So it's really not that big a deal, but you know, folks in our day and time are in a big hurry.
They are.
You know, my granddad always said, "I don't know why you're in such a big hurry. You're not going to do anything when you get there." So I kind of live by that, rule. But, you know, it really is a safety issue for mm-hmm. our farmers out on the road. So just folks, just be mindful of that. There'll be combines, there'll be trucks, lots of slow moving trucks, planters and tractors trying to plant these double crop beans and those kind of things. So just folks just need to be careful out there.
And all those pieces of equipment that David just mentioned are likely going to be in a row a lot of times. So if you get behind a combine, then there's likely going to be a tractor and some kind of a grain cart, you know, a lot of times, and there's going to be a tractor pulling the header. And then, you know, and if you got somebody that's going to bail up that straw, then you're going to have another tractor with a, possibly, you know, a baler, those types of things. So it's not normally it may not just be one piece of equipment. So if you're meeting one, just be prepared that there might be some more coming up too. And just, you know, just food for thought. If you are behind one, and you're, you know, trying to get around them and all of that, oftentimes just keep in mind they're setting up a whole lot higher than you are. They can see things that you are not going to be able to see from behind them. So a lot of times, if they're not getting over, keep in mind there's probably a reason, because they can see something that you cannot see. And that they're trying to keep you as safe, because I promise you, they do not want to be involved in an accident any more than you do.
Going back to what you just said about the good opportunity that there's several of these vehicles in a line or in a convoy working together, really keep that in mind when you think about passing a vehicle in mm-hmm. front of you, because the last thing you want to do is end up in the middle of that convoy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
These vehicles, depending on what it is, they're supposed to have escort vehicles front and back, depending on what the equipment is that is going down the road. Think about that when you're behind an escort vehicle, or when you see one approaching, that's your signal to back off, to stay off. Just this morning on my way to meet you all, I got met by what looked to be like a 2.5-ton service truck pulling a way wagon behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And gosh, it seemed like there was a half mile of traffic backed up in behind there, but everybody was seeming patient. Nobody was pulling out and looking. Mm-hmm. And really, they were on a stretch of road that if most of them knew it pretty well, they knew there was no place for this guy to get off.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that as soon as he had an opportunity to, he did.
And oftentimes, that's the case for a lot of the roads that these farmers are on. There's just simply not a place that is safe for them to get off, you know, and or to let you by. I mean, even if there's nothing coming, you just can't get around them.
Well, our infrastructure that we have in our road system is just not made for the size of the equipment that we have out today. It's really not. I mean, we've got equipment that's way bigger than it's wider than the road, to be quite honest with you, without the head on, is much, much wider than the road. So folks just need to realize that. A lot of the shoulders are really steep. You know, in a lot of this equipment, if you try to get off the road and you get the duals off the road, you could turn over.
Yeah.
And that's why they won't let you by a lot of times.
It is a safety issue. And,
yeah.
And then always keep in mind, too, that sometimes they're going to be making that left-hand turn and you don't know it yet.
Yeah.
And so the last thing you want to do is about the time they go to turn left and you run right into the side of them. You know, that could turn into a very bad situation. And so
I don't think we can say this for all passenger vehicles, but when it comes to our farm equipment on the roads, and I'll extend this to any large service vehicle, tractor trailers, you know, semi-truck drivers, whatever, what's good for them and safe for them is going to be good for that passenger vehicle in the long run.
Yeah.
They have conditions that they're driving in that are much more intolerant of any type of risk taking. So what's good for them and safe for them is going to be good for that passenger vehicle as well.
And another thing that you see up and down the road, now you'll see these all summer long too, is spray equipment. So these commercial sprayers are big and tall. And you know, I always see stuff on Facebook about this time of year that somebody will come up behind it in a little car and they're like, man, one of these days I want to drive right under it. I would not do that. That is not a good thought to have or a safe thing to do. And
I don't
actually
know who your Facebook friends are.
Yeah, I know. But I did actually talk to
my wife. Yeah. She's always said that I'd really like to drive.
Yeah,
would you want to do that?
I guess I'm old.
Well, and that's, I don't think any of my friends that I'm friends with on Facebook would do that. But, you know, it's like you have that thought. But actually, I talked to a friend of ours. He actually is a manager of a farm supply store. And that, he said, you'd be surprised at what people do. Like motorcycles,
sure.
You know, that they actually did have that happen. And you know,
I can
that is
that
a dangerous.
Well, it'd scare the driver to death.
And it is not, it's not going to turn out well if there was an accident.
Sure.
For that person, for anybody. But Just
because if he drove up under me, I can tell him what I'd do. I'd probably jump out of my skin. Y'all know how scared I am and can get startled. So,
any thoughts you have, just keep those in your mind and not, you know. Yeah. But just be safe out there. Yeah. Share the road.
And two, when we come into this time of year, we have lots of wheat stubble. It is usually normally pretty dry this time of year. Be careful driving I think it's a gas burning vehicles. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure. I don't think diesels are like this, but I don't know if it's a manifold that gets so hot. But there's something
it's on a catalytic converter
that gets hot on the gas burning and their ATVs.
Yes,
a lot of those will get hot, and we have a lot of fires that break out in wheat fields because of this. Folks just need to be really careful with that. A lot of times the farmers will have a tractor and a disc sitting there to be able to, or a water truck of some sorts to try to be able to. But I'm going to tell you, if you've never seen a wheat field catch on fire, it doesn't take long to get going, and it doesn't take it long to get going in a hurry, and it gets to be a pretty big area. And there's also light lines and different things. Folks that are driving combines, y'all need to be careful and cognizant of that as well, because some of these new lines that they're putting up.
I saw a Facebook post today
that you have talked about earlier that these new lines, and they may have swagged a little bit. The last time you went under them, they may have not have been there.
And those bend extensions on the combines.
That's right. And then also guide wires.
Yes.
You need to be very careful about where, when you're kind of backing up and trying to move and turn and different things around light lines. Just be real careful of that.
Lots of things that producers can be doing to get ready for wheat harvest, because it's essentially here. I mean, it's time. We know some folks have already been in the field, and some others that are just waiting for a little bit more moisture to get out of it before they get up and get going. But of all the normal things we do to prepare, putting these safety checklists together to think about are going to go a long way towards helping make a more, overall safe, overall experience for the people involved.
And
common sense is something that folks really need to pay attention to. And if you don't have any, you need to get some, because it'll help you through life for sure. But, a lot of these things are common sense kind of things to people that have been in agriculture. But if you haven't been around agriculture, you obviously can understand why that's not in their understanding. But that's kind of what we're here for. We're trying to help educate folks and about the whys and the why they do these things the way they do them. So folks just need to be careful out there for sure.
And again, anytime you're handling grain, just be safe with that. If you're putting grain in the bin or anything, if you're moving grain out of the bin to make room to put some wheat in the bin, whatever the situation is, if you're handling grain, always be safe and let folks know if you're going to have to get in that grain bin and make sure you're using the right safety equipment, because, you can get entrapped in that pretty quick, and you don't ever want to get that call. Your family doesn't ever want to get that call. So, just take the time to try to be as safe as you can.
More than once, we have talked about safety on this show, and I'm not sure what we don't need to put together a different safety checklist for every season that we go through, whether it's spring planting, whether it's wheat harvest, fall harvest, livestock, all the different seasons, anything that we're going to take part in on the farm, logging, whatever it is, there's some real safety hazards out there that folks need to be reminded of, and I know everybody gets tired of hearing about reminders to be safe, but I think we'd only be doing our job a little bit better if we made sure we included that in every season change.
And if we just saved one person, that would be it'd be worth it.
Absolutely,
sure. I mean, and the statistics are out there. I mean, the statistics of dangers or accidents on the farm and in agriculture is very high.
Agriculture is probably one of the most dangerous jobs out there. Absolutely. If it's not in the top five, I don't know why it wouldn't be. But
I think it is.
Well, yeah. I bet there's not anybody that's involved in agriculture that cannot tell you the name of a person mm-hmm. who's either been killed or seriously injured.
That's mm-hmm. right.
Every one of
yeah.
us.
Yeah.
yeah.
I mean, I can think just offhand of several. Mm-hmm. Of several. Mm-hmm.
And any facet of agriculture, and mm-hmm. there's many facets of agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just, you know, we've talked about it before, but I mean, even, I mean, handling pesticides and spraying and mixing and then just, I mean, there the list goes on. And so just, you know, try to be safe.
Some folks I used to work with that had some H2A workers. And, you know, they were working at the grain bins. And, you know, obviously they don't normally do that a lot where they're from. So what they've learned while they were here. And he had stepped straddle of an auger in the bin, and it got a hold of him. And, you know, it could have been a very serious situation. Luckily, there was another H2A worker there in the bin with him and got everything shut off. But so I asked him the last time I saw him, I said, you know, you doing that anymore? And he said, no. You know, so he learned a valuable lesson, and luckily there was somebody there to help him, you know.
Got a good friend. He's a former extension agent, worked for Kentucky Department of Ag for a lot of years. That doesn't live too far from us, actually, who was injured as a child in a I won't say it was they were harvesting silage at the time, putting up silage, but we need to get him on the show sometime mm-hmm. or another and mm-hmm. just talk about long-term effects and the things that go along with injuries like that.
Sure.
He was very, very fortunate. I mean, and he's gone through a lot through his years mm-hmm. because of the injury he had, but in the big scheme of things, he's lucky to have made it.
Yep.
And he is a big component of ag safety, and he mm-hmm. in his career he spent a lot of years with the Department of Ag.
I won't say his name until we talk to him about it, but you know, and make sure he'd want to do that.
Yeah.
But he spent a lot of years with the Department of Ag actually, you know,
promoting
ag safety all across mm-hmm. the state.
Yeah. So. That's exactly right.
But there's others as well. I can think of the, you know, in extension you're gonna end up more times than not maybe being in a court of law as an expert witness. And I had to, the first time I ever had to go do that, somebody was injured. PTO guard had been taken off mm-hmm. a shaft on a manure spreader, mm-hmm. got a jacket wrapped up in it and pulled him into it. And luckily did not hurt him as bad as it could have, but hurt him just the same.
Well, you know, it's how many times have we said it, and how many times have we been around other people that have said, boy, that could have been bad.
Every time that happens,
that is an accident waiting to happen.
Yep.
So if it could have been bad right then, mm-hmm. it's going to be another could have been bad tomorrow or the next day. Yeah. And so use that as a reminder to fix whatever the problem is.
Yeah. I remember went through hours of testimony from a lot of different people, and I was on the stand, and the defense attorney, the plaintiff's attorney, the guy who was injured, walked up and asked me one question. He said, have you ever been around a PTO shaft? I said, yes, sir. He said, should they have a guard on them? I said, yes, sir. He said, no further questions.
Yeah, that's right.
Because in that instance, it would have changed everything.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, I know that leads us into our timely tip, and I know, Jay, you've got a pretty good timely tip this time. So,
absolutely. You know, being in wheat country, David, like you and I and Vicky are, we want to remind folks to pay close attention to all the potential fire dangers that they could face during the wheat harvest, and really while planting back in that wheat stubble. Mm-hmm. In our area of the world, it's double crop soybeans. Other places, it might be another crop. But, you know, the fire dangers are there. They're widespread. Anybody that drives across the field we say gas-burning pickup trucks. You mentioned earlier, you know, small UTVs or ATVs mm-hmm. could potentially do this as well. Anything that's low that's going to scrape the bottom of that. A diesel vehicle's not quite as bad. They don't get quite as hot. They don't have catalytic converters, mm-hmm. and that's the big thing that gets so hot on the bottom of a mm-hmm. gas truck that causes these potential fires. So we want to be in that wheat field and out of it without any type mm-hmm. of incident whatsoever. So we just want to remind folks to pay close attention to all the potential dangers that may exist when it comes to potential fires in wheat harvest.
And, you know, in our area, a lot of the wheat fields are burnt off. I know in McLean County, they actually burn the wheat fields off. So if you're actually setting on a wheat field on fire on purpose, be sure to have that disc there. Be sure to have those water trucks there to be able to put that out if it was to get away from you. Mm-hmm. Just be sure you know what you're doing. And the wind blowing and all those conditions that we have, make sure you know what's going on and have enough people there to help you when time comes.
And go ahead and notify your local fire department. Absolutely. Let them know what you're going
to
be doing, too.
I was going to ask that, and this is an honest question because I don't know the answer to. I know a lot of people who do prescribed fires mm-hmm. in around, you know, logging operations for wildlife purposes and things like that actually have to be permitted to mm-hmm. have somebody on site and do that. Is it the same in agriculture mm-hmm. situation?
Nope.
No, I don't think you have to be permitted, but
it's a good idea to let your
it's a courtesy call if nothing else.
Yeah, volunteer fire department know what's going on.
Because undoubtedly what's going to happen is you're going to start that fire, you're managing it, but somebody's going to be driving down the road. They're going to see and they're going to call. So
one way or the other, the fire
department's
going to
get
there.
Yeah.
So it's a
courtesy call. Yep. Let them know what you're going to be doing, just so they're aware. And mm-hmm. then if it does get out of control, they're also aware. They're going to be on standby. So it's just a good thing to do.
Absolutely. Well, I think that just about wraps us up. We want to give special thanks to our host this week. We had no guest with us, so thanks to our hosts for this week's information. And thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show and will make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.